Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Do you remember a time when you didn't use email or download MP3s? The high-tech boom of the 90s brought an onslaught of technology that changed lives and, for some, stock portfolios, too. In this hour, the financial boom is over. Do you still believe in the technology behind the boom gone bust? We begin in Nigeria, where a group of unarmed women have shut down a major oil terminal for more than a week. The women, as many as 1,000 by some counts, have stormed a Chevron Texaco terminal and 4 pumping stations in southwest Nigeria. They're protesting the poverty and unemployment they face alongside the U.S. oil company's wealth. Nigeria is Africa's largest oil producer. The terminal pumps 500,000 barrels a day normally. A promising deal to end the standoff now appears on hold as negotiators work with the women to end the 10-day takeover. I spoke with Financial Times West Africa correspondent Michael Peel earlier in Lagos. I asked him to give us the latest from the protest at the Chevron site.
What appears to have happened is that the women who invaded the terminal, the Chevron terminal, Monday last week, have signed an agreement with Chevron to end the protests. But what has also happened is that some other women in the oil-rich Niger Delta region of Nigeria have invaded other Chevron facilities, and it's not quite clear what's happening there.
Michael Peel, why is it women who have taken on the oil company in this instance?
This is something of a departure and something quite novel in terms of protest in the Delta. Now, the relationship between multinational oil companies and local people in the Delta has been tempestuous for years, and you will recall the execution in 1995 by the military government of Nigeria of Ken Sarawiwa, the Ogoni activist who was campaigning for some of the same community rights issues that that these women are campaigning for. However, most of their campaigns, if not all, have been done by groups of young men, and they've tended to be violent. So this campaign is different in that, number one, it's women rather than men, and number two, that all reports seem to indicate that it's been entirely a peaceful protest.
What's the basis of the tension between the oil company and its neighbors there?
The people of the Delta feel that they have received insufficient return for the oil that has been extracted from their land and has for many decades contributed a large amount both to federal government tax revenues and to the profits of the multinational oil companies. The Delta is historically an underdeveloped, a poor region in a poor country, and in addition to that, people have to cope with all of the things that inevitably come with multinational oil operations in terms of pollution and other types of disruption.
Is there much support in Nigeria for these protesters, or are they seen as trying to extort the oil companies?
The makeup of Nigeria politically and ethnically is very complex. There are several hundred ethnic groups represented in the country, which is was a confection of the British colonialists who created the modern state of Nigeria in 1914. And so the views of the people of the Delta on this issue would not necessarily be the same as those of people elsewhere in the country. And, of course, it is a poor country where everyone is fighting for all of the revenues for development that they can get.
We read that the women trapped hundreds of American, Canadian, British, and Nigerian oil workers inside the terminal. How did they physically do that? They were not armed. How did they accomplish that?
It appears that they blockaded the runway at the terminal. This is according to Chevron. And that this had the effect of disabling the company's operations. But as I said earlier, no one, as far as I've seen, has suggested that any violence was used at all. This was entirely a peaceful city in protest, and from the start the women were quite clear about their demands. Their demands were for greater local employment, their demands were for greater development of local infrastructure in areas such as education, and that the agreement that's been signed with Chevron is apparently designed to try and address some of those concerns.
So Chevron Texaco has responded more fulsomely to their demands than they have to demands of men in the past, is that right?
I'm not sure it's as easy as saying that. I mean, certainly an agreement has been signed. The question perhaps is less what's in the agreement as to what will happen in the coming weeks and months, because there have been many cases in the Delta where local people say that they've been offered development investment by oil companies, but then the results have been disappointing, and for instance, buildings such as hospitals or schools have been built, but no supplies have been designated to them, and no teachers or nurses have been hired, which means that although the buildings are there, the facilities are effectively useless. So the real test of this will be what's actually standing there in 6 months' time.
And finally, Michael, is Chevron responding here to the protest on the ground or to the bad public relations that comes from having women protesting in the oil field they own?
That, of course, is the $64,000 question. You know, what would have been the outcome of this if, for instance, there hadn't been a reporter from the Associated Press on the ground who's followed the protest for the last week or so? We don't know the answer. I'm sure Chevron would say that they're a company that operates in a socially responsible manner and that they've conducted themselves as they would if there hadn't been a reporter there. But obviously that is one of the great unknowables.
Michael Peel is the West Africa correspondent for the Financial Times. He spoke to us earlier from Lagos, Nigeria. In the 1990s, technology was king. It promised stockholders and startups fantastic riches. It powered the American and global economies to unprecedented heights. We believed in technology and its limitless promise when times were good. Do we still believe in it now? For 10 years, James Glick tracked the meteoric rise of technology for the New York Times and the New Yorker, from wireless networking to personal digital assistants and global positioning systems. He joins us tonight to look at where technology has delivered, where it hasn't, and where we're headed now. Did you believe in the technology of the 90s? Did its impact fall short of your expectations or exceed them? And are you still hitching your dreams to technology? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is James Glick. His latest book is What Just Happened, a chronicle from the information frontier. Good evening and welcome, James Glick.
Good evening. It's my pleasure.
Good to have you with us. James, we're questioning lately all the icons of the 90s, it seems. The CEOs, the corporate books, certainly stock prices. What about technology? What was it all it was cracked up to be? Has it delivered? Was it also, in some degree, a mirage?
Well, first of all, no. Of course it wasn't all it was cracked up to be, and it never will be. Nothing ever is. But it seems strange to me that somehow technology has got caught up in all of our excitement and then anxiety about money and the stock market.
Well, it really can't help it, can it? It was so intimately wound up with money in the stock market for most of the 90s. I guess it's inevitable that it comes in for some scrutiny on the way down.
Well, it's true that it felt that way for a while. There were all these new millionaires running around, you know, 20-year-old millionaires, and the stock market, of course, got very excited about it, and there was a bubble. And really, most people knew at the time that it was a bubble.
Easy to say, but
everybody said so.
I guess. On the other hand, there's an awful lot of people who are wishing they would have perceived that more clearly or acted on that perception at this point.
Well, of course, that's the nature of bubbles. As horrible as it seems, I think a lot of people were saying, yes, I know these stocks are overpriced. I know it's froth. I know there's a lot of hype there. But, you know, I just really can't afford not to be buying these stocks.
I guess the thing that's captivating, James, is the way that the particular or peculiar power of the technologies of the 90s gave birth to such enormous dreams. Now that we've had to come back to reality a little bit, it seems like an interesting time to come back and look at those technologies and what it was or is about the peculiar power, impact, promise that got such immense expectations going. It was an unusual decade in that way.
Oh, it was, and you're making me feel a little embarrassed because I believed in the technology, and I still do believe in it. And I'd like to say that I never really believed in the dot-com bubble, and therefore I didn't really care that much about the dot-com crash. And in a way, all of the crash anxiety, in some cases hysteria, is more with us in the last few weeks than it was even a few months ago.
Oh, certainly.
And that has nothing to do with technology.
Well, take us right through that crash hysteria or rubble, whatever you want to call it, and remind us of what it was that was such an engine of excitement in the 90s and what it wrought.
Well, the thing that became an engine of excitement that created the bubble and was at the same time the subject of the bubble was this thing that we tended to call the internet or the online world or cyberspace or whatever we called. I mean, there was a time when we called it the information superhighway. Remember that?
It seems like ancient history now.
And all it really was nothing more and nothing less than everybody's computers getting connected. And what it meant was that everybody who had a computer and could get online somehow suddenly had a voice and became a publisher or an editor or a music distributor and felt powerful. And these things, in my opinion, really mattered, and they still matter. And because they spread so quickly, because speed and fast communication were the nature of the beast, businesses also got very excited about it and started churning and buying other businesses. And you know, there was a moment there when all you had to do to get a million-dollar job was walk into a tech company's office with a business card that had the word interactive on it.
We want to look at the technologies on their own terms, but this economic link is hard to get away from. One of the spinoffs of it, of course, was expectation of the new economy and the idea that this networking you're describing would create efficiencies, create productivity that would kind of overrule old economic laws or cycles and bring us into a new era. Maybe that's another reason that technology is coming in for this extra scrutiny now when people are saying, well, we're not so sure we're in a new economy after all. What's your sense of what expectations were there, what's really been accomplished there?
Well, I have to confess to you that I believe in the new economy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there was a lot of that talk was hype, and a lot of the companies that started up saying that they were going to be part of the new economy never actually had anything. They didn't have a business plan, let alone a product. But it wasn't all hype, and there are some things about the economy that are different now. Amazon is different. It's not just a bookstore that happens to lack a storefront. It really does something that's qualitatively different from other bookstores. eBay, the first of the online auction houses, is different, and the hundreds of thousands, or I'm sure they say millions of people who are buying and selling stuff every day, buying and selling junk, or going into their own antiques business, or exposing to the world their obsession with collecting, these people are doing something that is different from what they were able to do in the offline world just 10 years ago.
Does it add up to a new economy now, or is this still a subject of anticipation and these are just early harbingers?
I think it's a new economy, but not if that means, okay, now nobody has to work and everybody's going to get rich.
In 94, you said, I've seen the future and it's still in the future. Is it still in the future?
Well, yes. I guess I was trying to express the combination of anticipation and simultaneous disappointment that always goes with these fast-changing technologies. I mean, what I was doing in 1994 was, on the one hand, starting a little internet company of my own, which I did for about a year, and in the course of that, struggling with the telephone company the way all of us continue to struggle with our local telephone companies every day. That there's the excitement of the technology and the horrible cold water of the reality, and it will always be that way, I believe.
But you're saying that doesn't mean that something new hasn't been born in spite of the era of skepticism we've plunged into in recent months.
That's what I'm trying to say. That's what I deeply believe, that these technologies are real, and they have changed our lives already in profound ways, and we're just at the beginning, and we can only guess at what's going to happen.
It's hard to keep our eye on that sometimes with all the pushback that's come in the market and in popular culture as the market has headed down. But that's what we're looking at tonight. We're popping the hood on technology. We're looking at what it really gave us in the 90s and what's up next. We're talking with James Glick. You can join us as well. Has 90s technology delivered for the U.S. economy? Has it delivered for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're popping the hood on technology tonight and looking at what it really gave us in the 1990s. And what's up next? Our guest is James Glick. He's author of What Just Happened, A Chronicle from the Information Frontier. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. If it wasn't a new economy but just a bubble, does technology share part of the blame? Were we too eager in the 90s to believe technology would change everything, or has it? Is it the heart of the matter? Once again, you can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. James Glick, I wonder if there are times when we get into surges of technological evolution that are so rapid and so consequential that we're simply not able of adopting everything. Are we still swimming in the midst of more change than we've taken on board, than we're capable of taking on board?
Yes, I think that's right, and I think that's always what happens with these giant cataclysmic changes. You know, it's only a century or so since telephones started to become a part of every household in the United States. And when it was happening, people knew it was happening, and they knew that it was profound, and they made wild-sounding predictions about the future. And there were tremendous consequences for the economy. There were great battles over stocks and patents, and there was a lot of the kind of excitement that we see today.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, the growing pains of the telephone business are still with us. But for a long time, for most of the 20th century, we forgot about all of that, and we took the telephone for granted. It was one of the dullest appliances in our houses, and it just was a part of life. But if it disappeared, as occasionally it did, you know, occasionally there were telephone failures over
outages.
A particular region for a matter of days. People's lives changed dramatically, and they suddenly were forced to realize what the world was like without the telephone. Well, I think that's what's going to happen with all of these online technologies that are emerging today. They are going to become such a fundamental part of our lives that we won't be able to imagine what the world was like without them.
So what are we already blithely addicted or accustomed to that we might be shocked if it were taken away, that we might be shocked if we were whisked back to 1990?
Well, you mentioned as the program was starting that it's sometimes hard to imagine that as recently as 10 years ago we didn't have email. Now, of course, not everybody who's listening to us does have email or depend on it, but I would bet that most of your listeners do.
An awful lot.
And once you get hooked on email, it's hard to let go of it, and it becomes painful to change an email address, and you start to worry about the spam that is flooding in at every moment. And maybe you start to find that you don't talk on the telephone quite so much.
But it's a great example of something that people didn't know what you were talking about 10 or fewer years ago when you mentioned it. Today it seems almost mundane.
I was in my doctor's waiting room yesterday, and he had a couple of PCs set up where there used to be magazines, and there were two people sitting, presumably surfing the web. And the whole time I was waiting, they kept surfing. I kept waiting for one of the PCs to open up. But whatever they were doing, it was really important, and they didn't want to stop.
But is it possible that at some edge of the range of new technologies that have come into our lives or within sight of our lives now, we're not only up against a lag in adoption time, but is it ever possible to imagine being up against human nature? Is there a kind or a quantity of technology that simply exceeds human capacity to embrace?
I tend to think that there's always a certain level of tension. I don't know if there's any, if you can measure technology in that way so that you can say that some quantity is just going to be too much. I think we always feel, no matter where we are in the history of the species, that there's too much. You know, okay, now people are riding around our bucolic landscape on bicycles. Mm. That's too much, and I'm never going to be able to learn to ride one of those crazy things. And those railroad trains are belching smoke, and I hate the sound. You know, technology is always a mixed blessing. But new technologies always have downsides.
But do you really believe that the response, you wrote a few years ago a book called Faster, The Acceleration of Just About Everything, where you made the point that the speed of development, the speed of life had come to a historic kind of breakpoint with the past. Are we really still Ma and Pa Kettle coming out of the kitchen, wiping our hands on our bib overalls and shocked at the sight of an automobile? Or is there an accumulation of technologies that makes it qualitatively different somehow than that resistance to technology?
I don't know if it's qualitatively different. I think we're Ma and Pa Kettle, only instead of that shocking loud automobile, now we have a VCR that's still blinking 12, and twice a year when it's time to change the clocks for daylight savings time, we realize that half of the appliances in the house can't have their clocks adjusted unless we can find the manual. And we don't have the manual. And even if we did have the manual, we wouldn't be able to read it. And so then we may think, okay, we've reached the end. Technology has grown beyond the human capacity to understand and control it. But that's not what I think. I think there's always some technology that's beyond our capacity to understand or control, and then there's always some that we're getting used to. And then there's some that seemed impossible to our grandparents, and we've already forgotten it.
No matter what light speed volume of technology production is coming at us, that gives a lot of credit to human capacity for absorption. And maybe you're right. We're talking with James Glick. He's author of What Just Happened, a chronicle from the information frontier. We're really looking at technology, what it meant in the 90s, what it will mean in the decade ahead. What do you think? Has the bust taken the shine off technology for you? Or does it have you looking for the next big thing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mark is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Good evening, Mr. Glick. First, a comment. I think it seems to me, I'm a software developer, software mm-hmm. engineer, it seems to me that the new economy is more of a reflection of the greed that followed the invention of the actual technology itself, and the bubble and the bust really is totally disconnected from the capability or the ability of the technology itself to impact our society and our productivity. And it's that second point that I wanted to raise for discussion, mm-hmm. and then I'll hang up. 15 years ago, when we were seeing applications for factories and shoe companies to track their inventory and stuff, it took 40, 50 people and $1 million of hardware, a year and a half, 2 years to accomplish a task that would write software for that company. And now, with Linux operating systems, which is probably one of the best operating systems out there, it's totally free. I'm running on a $2,000 Dell box instead of a $150,000 or $1 million mm-hmm. proprietary box. I'm using Java and the web to create very hardcore applications in a very flexible manner.
So you're fully empowered by the technology.
Yeah, as a career, it's been very, very rewarding professionally and monetarily.
And I guess you're saying when you look at the bust, layoff of technology, it's an innocent player here. The hype just got carried away.
I think the people who were chasing perhaps the money of part of the equation, drove it up and then drove it down. And meanwhile, the ability of the technology to impact our workforce's ability to be productive in developing more of that technology or impacting mm-hmm. The more mainstream economy with that technology has not changed. And
has not changed. I think you're saying that the impact has been large.
I think it's been gigantic. Mm-hmm. I think, as I was before, the ability for us to deliver the same application, I'm delivering a higher quality application with a much smaller team in a much more flexible way, a much lower cost of capital for the business.
And before, Mark, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. James Glickman, that takes us exactly to this point.
Yeah.
It was that sense of exponentially growing productivity and empowerment of efficiencies that led people to say, we're in a new era. The stock market can go to 20,000, can go to 30,000. If all that productivity has been delivered, why aren't we still flying?
It has been delivered, and we are flying. We just don't realize it.
Hmm.
That's what I think. Occasionally, you hear a contrarian say, "This is." In fact, you could find people saying this every year for the last decade, that productivity gains from computing is a myth,
ephemeral.
That it isn't real. That for every employee who is made unnecessary by a computer, there are some other. You need three more employees to run the computer. You know? But I just don't believe that. I think if you take any medium-sized company in America, any company with say 100 to 500 employees, and tell that company, okay, you've got a few months to prepare, but we want you to operate without computers, it would be impossible. They'd be out of business. The productivity gains as a result of these technologies have been real. That doesn't mean that there wasn't a lot of hype. There was. It doesn't mean that there wasn't a bubble. But I think the caller is right, that the smart thing to do is to separate, on the one hand, the technologies, and on the other hand, the greed that contributed to the bubble and that now has emerged as the cause of this collapse.
Well, it's getting separated for us, I guess. Kyle's calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Kyle. You're on the air. Hello, Kyle. Are you there? Looks like we don't have Kyle. I want to bring in now another guest. James Glick, please stand by. We're joined, and I'm delighted to be joined by Paul Saffo from Menlo Park, California. Good evening, and welcome, Paul Saffo.
Tom.
It's good to have you back with us. Paul is director of the Institute for the Future, and we've talked in the past, Paul, about technology, the speed of its adoption, and what's coming up. When you look now at what's going on in the markets and the kind of cultural reconsideration of the 90s, as a futurist, given a chance now to look back on the 90s, are you surprised at the sort of whiplash, at the buyer's remorse to some extent that people seem to be expressing about the relationship of economy and individual lives and technology in the 90s, at this pause and reconsideration of what it all meant?
Not particularly. It was clear it was coming. Just as James said, it was clear that it was a bubble when it was happening. And as a forecaster, a very important part of my forecasting toolkit is a clear understanding of history. We've been through this before. What's unique, though, is the depth of anxiety and uncertainty because, of course, it's not just technology. There are other things going on, and the technology part is what we notice the most.
Do you, like James Glick, see a large element of this anxiety or disconcertedness being on a par with the kinds of unease that people have felt in generations past when new technologies came on stream? Or are we into a different velocity, a different scale of adoption that's more challenging?
Well, earlier generations have experienced the same thing, and the case can actually be made pretty well. There were periods where the sense of giddiness and anxiety and feeling overwhelmed was greater than today, but that's academic. The fact is the difference between history and the present is we knew how history turned out. We're still waiting to figure out how this one turns out, and that adds a certain poignancy to how we feel.
Mm-hmm. Help us turn the corner a little bit from the 90s to the decade ahead. Does the economic hiccup mean that we're going to see a hiccup in the pace of technology's advancement, or is it going to be pushing ahead with the same kind of surging speed that we got used to in the last decade?
Well, there are two sides to that. One is what generally happens with technology is things always arrive late in unexpected ways. So a whole bunch of ideas that were tried and failed in the 90s are now going to be turned into quiet successes in our lives. And there's a lot of stuff pent up that is still happening. And in fact, especially elsewhere in the world, the so-called wireless revolution is not so-called in places like Korea and Singapore and parts of Europe. It's quite real and quite extraordinary. So things are still going on. The open question is what happens with startup companies? Right now, we're about 9 months into a real drought of venture funding of startup companies. Too many companies, far too many companies, were funded in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. Now, far too few are getting funding. And if that gap lasts for a significant amount of time, say another year or two, then there really will be a blip 5 to 6 years from now. But it's still too soon to call.
But without that flow of investment capital going in, you're saying a gap could appear in the onward push of development.
Yeah, in terms of turning technologies into products that actually change our lives. The development is still going apace. It's that process of converting it into things that we can actually buy in the marketplace that could get held up. I am an optimist. I don't think we're going to really see a gap, though.
We're talking with James Glick and Paul Saffo about technology and the role it plays in our lives. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Do you expect that technology is going to keep on rolling, keep things cooking at the same kind of high boil that we've seen in the last decade? Bhaskar is calling from Amherst, New Hampshire. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I'm sorry for the poor quality of the phone. Actually, I'm calling on this mobile phone.
Oh, you know, that wired era just hasn't come out fully around yet, the wireless era.
That's right. This is one example of the technology, right?
Yes, it is.
So the point is that I think that people lost not confidence, but patience pretty soon. We expected, let's say, during 95 when the boom started, if it had gone for another few years, you would have really reaped a lot more benefits out of it than what we see today.
Do you mean financial or do you mean in terms of how we live?
The technology itself, as well as financial gains of it. For example, you know, the 3GL, which they talk about, the wireless, that could have come up, and a lot more could have come up. Actually, I'm a technical consultant, and I do a lot of technical consulting for a lot of companies, and I can see their need. I can see the technology fitting very well as a need. But only problem now is that because the funding is cut off, a lot of this advanced technology has gone away.
Bhaskar, it's an interesting observation. Let me put it to James Glick. James, are we already seeing a kind of gap between what was expected and what's actually being delivered? And why is that? Is it because of drying up investment capital or is it something else?
Well, I agree with Paul about the venture capital situation, that there was too much and maybe now there's too little, and conceivably that could be something to worry about. Psychologically, though, there's always a kind of gap between what we expect technology to deliver and what we actually find in our real lives. You know, we love our cell phones. I presume the caller loves mm-hmm. his. And then we discover when we first buy one that it's always got static, and the care and feeding of the batteries for the cell phone is taking up a half hour of our day that we didn't anticipate, and there are all kinds of hidden costs and sources of confusion, and that's the kind of gap between promise and reality that always interests me. It's completely different from the corporate gap.
Well, I wonder about that, though. Our caller, Bhaskar, is not really talking about consumer frustration. He was mentioning the wireless industry. There were wild, enormous expectations of that still seem to be sitting there largely static at this point. Why?
I think that's an illusion. I think that's a sort of things are moving quickly, but we're a long way away, and we can't see them moving.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Wireless networks continue to be taking shape invisibly behind the scenes. A tremendous infrastructure has been built. It was built during the 90s, and because of the fevered nature of the markets, a lot of the companies that built these networks are now out of business or going out of business. But that doesn't mean that the infrastructure is turning into vapor. It's real and it's there, and we're going to start to feel it surrounding us.
We're talking tonight with James Glick and Paul Saffo. You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're popping the hood on technology tonight and looking what it really gave us in the 1990s. And what's up next? We're joined by James Glick. He's author of What Just Happened, a Chronicle from the Information Frontier, and by Paul Saffo, joining us from Menlo Park, California, director of the Institute for the Future. You can join us as well. Take stock with this. Do you like what the last wave of technology has done for your life? And what do you want from technology now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul Saffo, you're always looking ahead at what's coming down the pike. What do you see in the next wave, in the next phase? And is it going to feel like the same kind of sizzle and excitement we saw in the 90s? Or was that a peculiar way of addressing new technologies?
Well, it wasn't peculiar, but it doesn't happen every year. That's something that here in Silicon Valley has occurred about once a decade. Mm-hmm. The difference for us this time was that everybody else participated. There is lots waiting in the wings. In the short term, I think you're going to see a whole bunch of things just quietly become real.
Such
wireless is, of course, the closest in. And it's unfortunately happening much slower here than it is abroad. But
when you say becoming real, we know we're using our cell phones, but what do you mean by becoming real?
Well, wireless data. Actually being able to, you know, the very strange thing about the World Wide Web is not so much that it arrived, but it arrived at the one place we don't want to spend any time, our desks.
Mm-hmm.
And what wireless does is it delivers it to where we actually live and work and play. And that very simple shift will have a profound transformative effect on the way we use the web and the kinds of things that are offered to us.
Paint a picture of the kind of consequences you anticipate.
Well, for starters, there are things on the web today that are interesting but not really big hits. Take MapQuest, for example, mm-hmm. looking up maps on the web. You know, you've got to be a very organized and slightly nerdy person to actually print out a map in advance of where you're going to plan that out. But if you're in your car or you're a couple of blocks away and you're lost and you can look at your PDA and get it, you're going to use it a lot more.
Mm-hmm. You've also written about sensors as a big coming thing. Describe what you're expecting there.
Yeah, the 90, it's the latest chapter in decade scale change. The 80s were shaped by the advent of cheap microprocessors. The personal computer was the poster child. The 90s were shaped by cheap communications laser. They're what made the World Wide Web possible, and that was a symbol of the decade. Now what we've got is very inexpensive sensor technology that allows us to give our computers and our networks, eyes, ears, and sensory organs, and observe the physical world on our behalf and manipulate it as well. And that is a huge, huge shift. We're seeing it in all sorts of places, from the UAVs, the unmanned aerial vehicles, flying over Afghanistan. Those are just flying computers with sensors on board. And, you know, cheap enough and common enough that every Al-Qaeda boss had their own personal UAV chasing them, to sensors in automobiles, to sensors in our cell phones, that all cell phones in the next 12 months will have a built-in position reporting system. So the cell phone network will know where that cell phone is. That's a sensor. This is a huge, huge shift.
And James Glick, when you look at these and perhaps other technologies coming on board, do you think it's going to be quite the same elixir that brought so many into that new economy boom in the 90s? I got my own feet wet in that boom in a dot-com startup. It seems like everybody on the block did. Are we going to see a repetition of that California gold rush?
I think in some ways we are, and for a peculiar reason, and that is that in the nature of this stuff is a tremendously expanded ability for each of us to communicate with all the rest of us. You know, the cliche is 500 TV channels and millions if you're on the World Wide Web, and so news and rumors and jokes bounce from one place to another faster and more efficiently than ever before. And so we're subject collectively to new forms of mass hysteria. You know, we saw, I suppose you would say that the dot-com bubble was an example of that, but there were other weird examples during the decade. Does anybody remember Y2K?
Sure.
We all thought for a year that the world was going to come to an end, that planes were going to fall from the sky, that banks were going to have to shut down, that electrical utilities were going to fail. Really, it sounds as though I'm exaggerating. But
is that technology-induced hysteria? You're suggesting perhaps it is.
I'm suggesting that it was induced in part by our mixed feelings about these fast technological changes, but also by our ability to communicate very quickly with one another, which means that there aren't just newspapers now. There are newspapers with their own websites, and the websites are competing with the newspapers, and then there are rumor sites that drive the newspaper websites.
Waves of information that don't depend even on an organized effort to keep them going. Alan's calling from Titusville, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Alan.
Good evening.
Hi.
I just wanted to go back to a couple points that were brought up earlier, and it was talking about where technology is actually going.
Yeah.
And I believe it's actually going to be in the application. The caller that talked about it used to take $1 million and 50 people to do something. Next year or this year, it takes a $2,000 PC and a few developers. Where this is all going to go, I think it's been eclipsed in this whole bubble. For example, the telecom bust, mm-hmm. You've got dozens of startups that have all died because they felt that they had to spend $1 billion and get moving very quickly. The thing is, if you look closely, there are some that are still out there and still growing, but they know their pace. They know to go slow, pick up customers, and keep moving as best you can. And I think I think things will improve. I think we'll get choice out of the deal. And with the growth of wireless, we'll be able to choose whether we get our internet via landline or via wireless.
But you feel like it's still coming right along. It's still coming at us, Alan.
It's been knocked down very, very heavily, but I think it can still get to us. I think we can do, we'll still get it. It's just a matter of perhaps when. And, for example, Mr. Glick's comment on infrastructure, the infrastructure is all out there. I'm talking to you on a cell phone that I'm 40 miles out mm-hmm. of anything that resembles a city. And 2 or 3 years ago, I used to have to carry the great big bag phone to get anything.
But now we've got you pretty loud and clear. Alan, thanks for your call. Barbara's on the line. Welcome, Barbara. You're on the air.
2 years ago, I had someone graduate from college with a degree in electrical engineering and computer science, and he had job offers all over the place and blah, blah, blah. I have a kid who just graduated in June, same degree, and nothing. And with so many experienced engineers and people in technology laid off, what place is there for a young, inexperienced person in this field?
Barbara, it's a good and earnest question. Let me put it to Paul Saffo. Paul, many people have hitched their wagon to technology one way or another in terms of jobs and expectations. Barbara's got a very real question about a son who's got a degree and can't find a job. Is this just a cyclical thing? Is he going to get picked up?
Yeah, it's cyclical. And, of course, any parent these days with a college student has to worry they're going to move back in with them until they're 30.
Right. Just how cyclical, Paul?
It's picking up. It's a little tricky for new college grads. There's no way around the fact that the market is a wasteland at the moment. As the joke making its way around the valley goes, what's the new status symbol in Silicon Valley? Mm. Answer, a job. But in the larger sense, the failure is actually setting the stage for the next wave. What we just did with this extraordinary bubble is we took a whole bunch of 20-somethings. Mm. They went in, they went up, they started their companies, they went down, they came out, and their whole business careers are still ahead of them. In effect, what we just did is took a whole generation and ran them through an entire career at accelerated pace. They're wise beyond their years. And as far as I can tell, none of them are saying, oh, gee, that was a bad idea. I'm going to go work for IBM or HP. They're all saying, gosh darn it, I'm going to do it right. Those bosses of mine were fools. And just as soon as I can get the venture capital, I'm going back in. So I think in fairly short order, once the money picks up and we, get through the crisis, there's going to be a whole wave of new startups. And of course, they will be hiring.
So watch out for the next wave. Paul Saffo, Director of Institute for the Future, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
James Glick, just 20 seconds left, but last word goes to you. Can we still put our trust in American technology to carry things along?
Well, yes. It's important to keep some perspective. Mm-hmm. Nobody out there is saying, okay, all of the stocks have crashed, especially the telecom stocks, so I'm going to stop using the telephone or stop using email mm-hmm. or stop buying computers. They're just saying the stock market has crashed, so maybe I'm going to stop buying stock.
And that they have, but that doesn't keep the technology from churning. James Glick, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
James Glick is author of What Just Happened, a chronicle from the Information Frontier. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the best of bad writing. This is On Point. Earlier this week, the Baldwin Lytton Awards were handed out. Now, not everyone can win a Pulitzer, but even the worst writer in the world can win a Baldwin Lytton. Named after the second-rate author who penned the frequently mocked phrase, "It was a dark and stormy night," the Baldwin Lytton Award is given annually to the writer who submits the worst opening sentence to an imaginary novel. Scott Rice, an English professor at San Jose State University, launched the contest in 1982. It now receives thousands of entries per year. In this radio diary, Rice explains why he created an award for bad writing.
The Baldwin Lytton contest started out as something of a lark, as a parody on campus literary contests, which are deadly serious affairs and attract a good deal of bad writing. So here at San Jose State, we thought, why not be up front and tell people we want bad writing to start with, but don't send us a lot of it. We just want bad opening sentences to imaginary novels. What we like to see is sentences that are bad in a flagrant kind of a way that tell us something about what makes for good and bad writing. For example, this year's winner and some of the winners in the past show what happens when writers pick up a simile or a metaphor and then can't put it back down. This is from Ms. Reefa Berg from Oakland, California. On reflection, Angela perceived that her relationship with Tom had always been rocky. Not quite a roller coaster ride, but more like when the toilet paper roll gets a little scorched so it hangs crooked. And every time you pull some off, you can hear the rest go bumpity-bumpity on its holder until you go nuts and push it back into shape. A degree of annoyance that Angela had now almost attained. I mean, why not just say that a relationship with Tom was a little bit like an unsymmetrical toilet paper roll or something, but instead she starts going into detail, like when a toilet paper roll gets a little scorched so it hangs crooked, and every time you pull some of it off, you can hear the rest going bumpity-bumpy on its shoulder until you go nuts and push it back into shape. I mean, you wonder when it's going to end. For the most part, these comparisons are devices of economy. And so it's kind of a joke when one of these economic devices becomes long-winded and out of control. The sun beat down like a molten hammer upon the sand that Jasper trudged on, scorching his bare skin, baking his eyeballs dry, boiling his brains in his skull, and bleaching his hair to that lovely yellowish shade that perfectly matched his taupe shirt, the one that he could wear with either a suede jacket or the denim one. Or Herman lay with Esmeralda, entwined with one another among love-tangled sheets, and he thought how this one constant yet mercurial woman was one whom he could hold in his arms forever, although eventually he would have to get up and go to the bathroom. Or here's one of my favorites. Ralph awoke groggily, and after searching through the overflowing ashtray on the nightstand for a half-smoked cigarette, looked over at the rumpled form of Lila sleeping next to him in bed, and wondered idly why making love with her made him feel as though his body had been pounded by heavy surf. One conclusion I've come to as a result of the contest is that many times when we try hardest, when we're most serious and we most apply ourselves, we are also most conventional, that we're more likely to stay inside of kind of recognized boundaries and become cliched. And what the contest does is pull out all the stops and tell people they can be wild and crazy, push the envelope, go over the edge, whatever, you know, pick your own cliché to describe that. And as a result, they become more imaginative. And so some of these sentences are, in their own perverse ways, wonderful. And I ask people, how long did it take you to write that sentence? And sometimes they say, a couple of minutes, or else they'll work a lot longer on something more straight-laced. And so I think that's one valuable insight, that to escape the mundane and the humdrum, you know, you have to let go of your normal outlooks and expectations and so forth and just let go. And in the process of being crazy, we sometimes find the truth.
Scott Rice is an English professor at San Jose State University. You can read other Bulwer-Lytton Award-winning entries by checking out our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian.